thoughts that people bring to bear in politics themselves. So politics will become the continuation of economics, or economic competition, or group competition, as if it were not to be governed by some different kind of ethos than economic life. And his sense was that that the role of the American civil religion was, his sense was that the American founding fathers nonetheless decided that they would take the risks of corruption, the risks of selfishness in the public square, that they would create what he called, and what they called, a commercial republic. That a they would create a commercial republic, which is to say, a republic in which the majority of the population is very involved in getting and spending, in commerce, in mercantile activity, and yet the system as a whole will remain a republic and hopefully not be infected by this ethos. And now there is a solution to this, which Madison came up with, which is, of checks and balances, and if you look at Federalist 10. But Bella doesn't mention that. To Bella's mind, the role of this American civic religion, or civil religion, is to keep us from succumbing to the ethos of the economic sphere, that the American civic religion, by its emphasis upon patriotism, by its emphasis upon love of and attachment to and zeal for the common weal, for the common good, will check these negative propensities of the economy. So that's his first argument. And he says that American civil religion does this. His second argument, which is a little different, and he says there that the other anxiety which one should have about American political life without civil religion, the other anxiety is that Americans may come to deify the state, that they will, that as we've seen in so many awful instances in the 20th century, that people will conflate, mistake the good of their group, or the good of their class, or the good of their movement, or the good of the country with the good per se. And he takes this critique from Reinhold Niebuhr, who argued that monotheism, radical monotheism, is a corrective to this wrong-headed deification of the state. And so Bella looks to civil religion and says, civil religion is essential in American life because without it, we run two risks. One, we will become obsessed with the mercantile spirit, and that will destroy our political life, and we will lose all awareness of the common good. And on the other hand, there's always the risk that we will absolutize our political self-interest, we will absolutize the American interest, we will mistake the American, what's good for America with God's will. And he was writing actually at the time of the Vietnam War, and many criticized him for making this argument on behalf of civil religion, and he was saying, because they thought it kind of played into this confusion whereby the state and its God and its good are all one. And he said no, that the American civil religion is actually rooted in Judeo-Christian ethical monotheism, that the God of America, or the God of the American civil religion, is the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus. And so long as Americans have a higher loyalty to that God, they will keep their collective egotism, that is to say their national egotism, in check. So my argument is that Bella is right about the role of civil religion, but where I would differ with him is he was pointing to this thing that was supposedly out there, this thing called the civil religion. But and he pointed to the stories of the founding fathers, the stories of our he pointed to the symbols of the American polity. He pointed to our holidays in which we are reminded of these important values. But my sense is that civil religion that he was talking about was an illusion. in the sense that it was not self-sustaining. And his argument implicitly acknowledges that the real base of this civil religion that plays and needs to play an important role in American political life is the actual communities of faith, the Jewish communities, the Christian communities, the Muslim communities, the communities of faith that nurture this, A, this loyalty to a God that transcends the polity, and two, are the places in which the love of, in which the sympathy for the common good, in which the feeling for the common good, in which social solidarity is taught and learned and transformed into a form of practice. And ideally, and here's where, so, and I think that in that respect, American religions play a crucial role. One more point, and then I'm done, which is, but my critique of the American religious communities today would be that while they are effective, let's say, at teaching social solidarity, soup kitchens, shelters, food pantries, these are all face-to-face, imminent expressions of a desire to help the neighbor in distress, there's a general failure to make the move from face-to-face compassion to political endeavor. And while there's a long tradition that says that we should, in fact, be involved in tasks of gemilut chasadim, I would argue that today we have greater power, and we have a greater understanding of the social causality of these problems, and so the future for American civic or civil religion lies in the communities of faith actually preaching a level of political engagement and political involvement that goes beyond the social action model of many of the churches and synagogues. And I think that there's hope for that, and I think 9/11 presents us, the wake of 9/11 presents us with a great moment in which that might happen. So, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Sorry about that.
Okay. And now our respondent, Kevin Hassan.
Thank you. An apologia and a commercial. Apologia, I am not a rabbi. I am not even a Jew. I'm a Gentile human rights lawyer. And I find myself as a guest here, and I will be a good guest. However, I'm supposed to be the respondent, which is a polite word for provocateur. So I won't be too good a guest, because that wouldn't be very much fun at all. Now for the commercial. The organization that I run, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, defends one idea in three fora. The fora of the courts of law, the court of public opinion, and academia. And the idea is that because the religious impulse is natural to human beings, religious expression from all traditions is natural to human culture. We're not the Christian right, but we're not syncretists either. We believe everybody has the right to be wrong. And if you got any of my two of my clients together in any one day, they would start a fight. But I believe they all have the right to be wrong. So for example, I don't know if you recall the case where we defended the mechitza and the school buses in the Diamond District in Manhattan for the Skvera Hasidim. We successfully defended their right to have rolling synagogues in Manhattan. We defended the right of a Reform congregation in Philadelphia to have a synagogue. They wouldn't speak to each other. None of them would be happy, neither of them would be happy terribly. We defended the right of Muslim police officers to grow beards in Newark. And all of them would condemn the Zoroastrian temple that we successfully defended the right to have in Fairfax County. We do it because we think religion is a basic human right, and it's that from that perspective of a human rights lawyer that I want to try and start an argument. When China imprisons Tibetan Buddhists simply for possessing pictures of the Dalai Lama, and the American government says, "This is an outrage against religious liberty," China inevitably responds, "You are unwisely interfering in our internal affairs." My question is, are they right? When the Sudan literally enslaves Christian and animist children, and the American government says, "This is an outrage against religious liberty," the Sudan inevitably says, "You are unwisely interfering in our internal affairs." Again, the question, are they right? When Iran persecutes the Baha'i simply for being the Baha'i, and we protest, they say, "You're unwisely interfering in our internal affairs." Are they right? That is a terribly important question for religious liberty, not only in China and Sudan and Iran, but for religious liberty in America, because it's only a restatement of the question, where does religious liberty come from? Does it come from American positive law? Does it come from convenience, or does it come from somewhere higher? If it comes from American positive law, if it's that simple, if it comes from the First Amendment, then the answer to the question, are they right, is very simple. Yes. It's very troubling, too. You look in Article 48 of the Chinese Constitution and say, well, this is nice. It would be even nicer if they enforced it. But it's still no First Amendment. Too bad for the Buddhists. Next case. Sudan and Iran have nothing comparable to a First Amendment. Next case. We don't say that because we believe there is something much more fundamental at play in those situations. My understanding of Professor Novak and Professor Broyd is that they would answer the question, are they right? No, in Professor Novak's case, and maybe in Professor Broyd's case. Because in Professor Broyd's understanding, the question of whether one defends the rights of non-Jews, of Gentiles, is entirely a question of what is good for the Jewish people. That seems to me to be another way of saying there are no universal human rights. And in particular reference to China, Sudan, and Iran, the answer would almost certainly be no. For China, Tibetan Buddhists are the worst kind of dissidents there are because they're separatists. They want a free Tibet. Anybody who sticks up for Tibetan Buddhists can't expect any good things to come from them, to them from China. In Sudan, the Christians, the animists in the south are likewise rebels. Anybody who sticks up for them is in no position to get anything good. And of course, in Iran, the Baha'i are heretics. Jews and Christians, at least, are second-class citizens, people of the book, but the Baha'i can be killed with impunity. Anybody who sticks up for the Baha'i can expect nothing from the Iranian government. So from Professor Broyd's perspective, I think the answer would have to be, yes, they're right. And that's very troubling. It's ultimately troubling for America, because if religious freedom is not a fundamental human right, then it's repealable. The same government that gave it to us can take it away. What if it is a human right? What if the First Amendment was a political compromise that did the best it could, aspiring towards being something better? My view, Madison's view, Jefferson's view. Then the right of religious liberty is found not in the contours of what is good or bad in realpolitik, and is not found in what is written or unwritten in American positive law, but is found in the contours of the human heart. What are those contours? I'll argue there are two. Demonstrable simply from human nature, not from the revelation of any particular tradition. First is that human beings come with a built-in thirst for transcendence. We are at our best when we are seeking to find and embrace an ultimate truth that lies beyond the horizons of ourselves. We are at our best. We also seek a horizontal transcendence. We seek to reach out and embrace not just an ultimate truth, but other people around us and everything that's essential to our humanity. We don't smuggle babies home from the hospital in secret. We have brises, we have baptisms. We don't come of age in secret. We have bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and my tradition confirmations. We don't typically elope in secret. We have egregiously expensive, outlandishly elaborate celebrations. And we don't, unless we've murdered somebody, sneak off in the dead of night to bury them in a landfill. We gather together to weep together. We don't do all these things because we don't live alone. Well, we don't believe alone either because we don't live alone. We naturally want to celebrate whatever it is that is our tradition in public. So Dr. Gottsagen argues that religion is a public good because it's good for the public. I think it goes deeper than that. I think religion is a public good because humans are public people, and religion is a human good. Now, what does this look like in the public square in America? What would it look like? We've never tried it this way. Religious pluralism in Western, well, in human history is a relatively new phenomenon, and we've only been at it with any seriousness for about 50 years in America. We're not very good at it yet. But there are only three possible models, logically, for religious pluralism. One is the Crusader model. The second is the secondhand smoke model. The third we'll call the Jersey City model. The Crusader model is where one worldview seeks to hijack the power of the state to impose itself on everybody else. It is always and everywhere immoral. It's immoral whether it's late 15th century Spain, whether it is late 20th century Soviet Union, whether it's early 21st century Afghanistan. It is always and everywhere immoral. A very tempting alternative, tempting since the 1960s, has been what I'll call the secondhand smoke model, which says, this religion is just so dangerous that we have to privatize it. We have to say, you can imbibe religion like you can imbibe cigarette smoke in private, consensually, but it's very, very impolite to do it in public, and it's the government's job to protect you from it in courthouses and train stations. That's deceptively successful because it oppresses everybody equally. It's a lie to us from our government about who we really are. If the government were simply the night watchman of libertarian fame, that there was nothing else the government did except provide for the common defense and run police departments, then it wouldn't be a lie. But our government does everything. We celebrate everything from National Catfish Day to National Jukebox Week, and I'm not making those up. We have a comprehensive public culture. We have a comprehensive public education. And to have a comprehensive public culture and public education that comprehensively say absolutely nothing about one's search for transcendence is not to say nothing about one's search for the transcendence. It's to say something. What does it say? It says that it's, at best, an optional hobby for people. That lies to us about who we really are. It's really just a variant of the Crusader model. The third model, the Jersey City model, I have 1 minute left, Alan, and I know it, takes its name from a Beckett Fund case. We spent 2.5 years defending Jersey City, New Jersey, from a lawsuit by the ACLU. Sometimes we're on the ACLU side, sometimes we're not. Jersey City is ethnically, religiously, culturally, per capita, the most diverse city in America. There are 60 or 70 different ethnicities. There are flag raisings every week for flags I've never seen before. They have ethnic celebrations on a daily basis. And in the midst of it all, they have a menorah for Hanukkah, they have a nativity scene for Christmas, they proclaim Ramadan, and they celebrate the Hindu Festival of Lights with the Grand Pagwa Parade. And next to it all, the parade's going back and forth, the flag's going up and down, and everything else, they have the same sign accompanying every display. Through this display and others throughout the year, Jersey City is pleased to celebrate the diverse ethnic and cultural heritage of its people. The ACLU said the religion only had to go. We said, no, a time-lapse photographer would catch it all, and anybody who saw that time-lapse photograph would realize the government wasn't pushing Hinduism, wasn't pushing Islam, wasn't pushing Judaism, wasn't pushing Christianity, was simply recognizing religion's role in culture generally. And as long as 1,000 flowers were blooming, no one would misunderstand. That, I think, is the model that logically follows from who we really are. It is a model that I would be very interested in hearing Dr. Novak comment on, Professor Broyd attack, and Dr. Gottsagen's thoughts. So I hope I've been a good guest, but not too good a one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to everyone. If we had a lot of time, I would love to have the speakers engage each other, but we don't have a lot of time, so I'd like you to engage each other and engage them. Our job in this project is to generate ideas, throw out ideas to stimulate, provoke, and encourage further thought on these weighty matters. So please, if you'd like to ask a question, and only questions, please, no speeches. Come up to one of the microphones and address any of the speakers or all of the speakers.
I would like to hear Dr. Novak's response.
Okay. Okay, if nobody's running up, so let's do that. Let's have the speakers talk a little bit, just a little bit, and then we'll...
From our seats?
Yeah, you can do it.
Okay. I have to inform you so you don't think that there's any collusion with halachas called kanunya. Professor Broyd and I normally don't call each other Dr. Novak and Professor Broyd. We're on a first-name basis. We've known each other for a long time. And I think we've had an interesting conversation over the years because we have enough in common to have a conversation and enough differences to make it interesting. So here goes. I am not advocating that there be, quote, a or even, let alone the Jewish position on every single social issue. But I'd like to illustrate my point by, since Michael Broyd referred to the synagogue. The synagogue that I go to in Toronto, which is a large Orthodox synagogue, I have a problem with two of the prayers that are said in our synagogue. Now, fortunately, neither of these prayers are kind of central to the liturgy. So, I mean, I don't have a problem with the Shema or any of the other major prayers, God forbid. I have a problem with the prayer that we say on behalf of the government of Canada, and I have a problem with the prayer that we say on behalf of the state of Israel. And when these prayers are said, I only say part of the prayers. I delete a couple of lines from each one of them. It's said out loud, standing up with the congregation, so I don't make any kind of spectacle of myself. When it comes to the prayer for the state of Israel, the line that says that, and I certainly support the state of Israel and in favor of it, the line that says that it is Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, the beginning of our redemption, that regards the state of Israel as literally being a messianic event, I have religious problems with. As much as I support the state of Israel, I agree with the late Professor Yeshayahu Leibovitz that this is a dangerous mixing of messianism and politics. So in the synagogue, when that line is said, I just simply don't say it. And it doesn't create any halachic problem or whatever. I just simply don't say it. I can't say it in good faith. The second prayer we say is a prayer on behalf, and of course I live in Canada, of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, the Governor General, and the Prime Minister and the Government of Canada. The equivalent in the United States would be the President of the United States and the Congress and whatever. What's wrong with that? Nothing is wrong with that except the implication of the prayer that we are some kind of foreign body as Jews in either Canada or the United States. This prayer was formulated when Jews were really not citizens of the countries in which they were living. Jews before the French Revolution, especially in virtually every country in Europe, were a foreign entity, like a foreign embassy on French or German or whatever kind of soil. And we had a special contract with the monarch. We were not citizens. We were not participants in the society. We were foreigners in the society who were living there under the sufferance of the society. Now, it seems to me that this is entirely different in a society such as the United States or Canada, where we are citizens and where I think we should not only have opinions in terms of as individuals, but there are times that I think that we should speak as Jews. And there's enough warrant in our tradition. And I'll give two examples. One example concerns Professor Broyd this very day. I was riding up here on the plane from Toronto, and I just had received in the mail the day before the names of a list of people who signed an affidavit on behalf of a Mormon woman at the University of Utah who protested that she had to use profanity and blasphemous language as part of her drama program. Now, on the list of the amici curiae, the friends of the court, people who filed I didn't read everybody's statement, but on that list was Professor Michael Broyd, Rabbi Gedalia Schwartz, head of the Beit Din in Chicago, where my daughter and her family live, Rabbi Barry Freundel of a synagogue that I go to when I am in Washington, which is frequently, and myself. So apparently, we all thought that this was something that required some kind of statement. We were all identified clearly as Jewish scholars and rabbis and whatever. That's number one. Number two, one of the issues in Canada that is, and it's probably been debated in the United States, it was in Hawaii, is the question of same-sex unions. Now, I think that the Jewish tradition has an opinion on that, and I think the Jewish tradition has an opinion on that that applies to everyone, not just Jews. I filed an affidavit, which created a tremendous stir in Canada. There were phone calls to the University of Toronto calling for my dismissal on the grounds that I'd abused my authority as professor of Jewish studies, even though I filed it as an individual. Well, I also persuaded the Bet Din of Toronto to sign on as an amicus brief. I pointed out to the Bet Din of Toronto, of which I'm not a member, but I pointed out to them that if you don't give a Jewish perspective on this, then there will be secular Jewish organizations who will, and you're not going to like what they say about, quote, a Jewish position, let alone the Jewish position. Apparently, I was persuasive because they did endorse my affidavit. So here again, I don't think that there needs to be a Jewish position on everything, but I think that to talk about the world out there as if we were not participants in it, even the state of Israel, which is a sovereign Jewish state, is still a participant in, not a part of, but a participant in a larger world order. And therefore, for that reason, I think earlier models of just kind of not worrying about what the Gentiles are doing is something that is not the case because we are fellow citizens with them, something which is a rather new factor in human history.
Good evening. Heard mention of a couple of medical related issues earlier, and there's another one that's been getting more attention in the last few years, and that's the issue of male circumcision. And I, what I've heard and read in the media are things like Jewish advocates are claiming that the critics are anti-Semitic, and also that some of the advocates, for example, a proportion of doctors who advocate circumcision are Jewish, and some of the critics claim that maybe there should be some separation, or that one being Jewish may be an influence on medical opinion. I mean, it's just a very complex, sensitive issue, and it seems to raise very strong feelings on both sides. And at the same time, a growing number of people feel there's a need for public discussion, and of course, again, touching on areas of religion and sexuality, et cetera. So I'm wondering if the members of the panel might have some suggestions about how to facilitate public discussion of this controversy.
Anyone want to rise to the occasion on that?
So I'm going to be ever practical, because that is my motif in life. I think the Jewish community needs to vigorously work protect the right of people to practice ritual circumcision independent of any medical evidence for it or against it, and independent of a reasonable secular assertion that optional surgical procedures should not be conducted on children until they're of the age of consent. Notwithstanding both of these principles, which in the abstract strike me as vaguely reasonable, the Jewish community seeks not to be an ideological participant, but a protector of its own interests. And since, in my view, essentially we adopt practical positions rather than philosophical positions, practical position here is to defend the right of circumcision in the United States so that there should be the right of circumcision, R-I-G-H-T, should be allowed to exist so that there should be a right of circumcision, R-I-T-E. I don't need a theoretical basis to do this. And we should form whatever practical coalitions are necessary to defend our right to practice our religion as we see fit.
I agree with the practical result, but I think it's important, and I would take the case, and if anybody ever needs a lawyer, we work for free.
Those are the best kind.
You have an unlimited supply of clients when you do that. However, it's important you can't win cases, and you shouldn't win cases without philosophical reasons behind them. And this is a great example of the free exercise of religion. It's a perfect example of the free exercise of religion. Not just believing something, but having to do something. and the government not being allowed to interfere simply because it doesn't understand. It's a perfect example of the free exercise of religion. It shouldn't just be an exercise in power politics, although if power politics is what it takes to enforce the free exercise of religion, more power to it.
Yeah, but speaking of coalitions and practical politics, I was just commenting to a Muslim colleague of mine at the University of Toronto, considering that, you know, the tensions between Jews and Muslims in this day and age. There are two things that I think would make a marvelous coalition of Jews and Muslims and bring them together, certainly in North America. Number one would be an attempt to ban the circumcision of infants, because Muslims do it as well, different age, but still most Muslims do it anyway. And the second thing is that, once again, the notion is being floated of the canonization of Queen Isabella, who, if you recall, expelled both the Jews and the Muslims from Spain in 1492. That would certainly bring Jews and Muslims together. But to be serious about it, this is a very serious issue. And I don't think that it's only motive. I mean, one can always see an anti-Semitic motivation in it. But I will take it, for example, Professor Margaret Somerville of McGill Law School in Montreal. A strict civil libertarian, argues that that involuntary surgery, which is not life-saving surgery, on an infant is a violation of their rights. In other words, here again, the people should decide if they want to be circumcised when they are adults. Now, were this to become, it's a minority view, but I've said this to Canadian Jewish audiences, were this to become the law in Canada, then every one of these somehow 300,000 Canadian Jews would seriously have to question whether he or she could remain a citizen of Canada, since there are other options. This is serious business. Now, in terms of what Mr. Hassan was saying, I think that there's also a point here, and that is, it's a notion of how we enter civil society. Do we enter civil society as simply lone, anonymous individuals with a minimal set of rights, or do we enter civil society coming from rich, thick, traditions, which are inevitably concerned with the transcendent, i.e. religious. And that is the big difference. The fact is that we Jews have to believe that we enter civil society, not as lone individuals, but coming from a very rich religion and culture. And if that civil society is not going to make it possible for us minimally to practice our own religion, if we have an alternative, then we have to seriously consider whether we can be loyal to that society or not. So this is a fundamental question. It's even become a question in Canada with a small Mennonite-like community who are actually being, their children are being taken away from them because they practice spanking, claiming that the Bible says, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. Now, they regard this as their religious right. They do not say that their children should be brutalized, and they would certainly agree that if a child were, you know, being beaten to the point of brutality, they should be taken away from his parents. But they regard this as part of their parental right. This is an intrusion of the state upon the prior religious rights of a community. These religious rights are not individual rights, they're communal rights. Another example, the Human Rights Commission in Saskatchewan required a Baptist church to remove from its bulletin board a quotation from the book of Leviticus saying that a man should not lie with a man as he was lying with a woman from the 19th chapter of the book of Leviticus, claiming that that was hate speech. I mean, that was hate speech. Yeah, I mean, we chuckle about this, but there is a militant kind of secularism in our society, which basically regards religion, that is religious traditions, as the enemy. Now, it seems to me that thoughtful Jews, and for that matter, thoughtful Christians or thoughtful Muslims, should be very concerned about this and indicate why this is not only detrimental to them as religious communities, but undemocratic in terms of the way we understand a democracy. These are very important issues that I think have to, unfortunately we have groups like the Beckett Fund and whatever that will actually be willing to go into court when this, because all these issues wind up in court one way or another.
We have time for just one more question, then Professor Wolf is passing. Anyone else?
Could I just respond to this?
There's one more question out there.
I'd like to point out to tension that there is between the idea, the notions of equality and pluralism that Professor Hassan has brought up in the ideas of Jewish law that requires Jewish people to do what they need to do, which it does, I mean, equality and pluralism are not high values in Jewish law, and whether people, whether Jews like it or not, they have to, if they obey the halakhic law, they have to go by it. And this tension plays out very strongly, itself very strongly in Israel between a democratic state and Jewish state, where people that pursue pluralism have a problem with having religious laws and things of that kind. And I think, it's a major tension, and I don't know how it can be solved, but it's two different views, I think.
Can I? I think that this goes to, you raised a very basic question in your comments. As I understand the Jewish tradition, religious pluralism is a practical value, and it is not a theological value. We do not believe that people have the right to worship whatever God they want in whatever way they wish, and we are overtly hostile on a theological level to, for example, paganism or polytheism, and that nobody vested in the Jewish tradition can advance a philosophical mandate within the Jewish tradition supporting paganism or polytheism.
You can't do one in the Christian tradition either.
I agree with that, and you can't do it in the Christian tradition either. Thus, if you wish to defend religious liberty in the Jewish tradition, you have to do it in a practical way, which is, in my view, the defense of the Baha'is is grounded in a calculus, which is defending the right of the Baha'is betters the lot for everybody, which may be true, may not be true. And the only way you can advance the agenda of the Beckett Fund consistent with your own religious beliefs is by adopting a practical defense, which is religious pluralism advances the religious rights of us all. Certainly as a good Catholic or a good Jew, we are not religious pluralists. We are truth seekers, and the truth that we seek causes us to recognize that some religious beliefs are false. And the only way we can defend the right of people to advance religious beliefs that we think are false is by saying the consequences of living in a society where false beliefs denounce each other and kill each other is the Crusader model, and that makes us very uncomfortable practically. But of course, if God's hand were apparent on this earth and he were directing the Crusaders, we would be more comfortable. But I don't see that.
Do you remember the Pink Panther movie? I thought you said your dog did not bite, and the answer was, that's not my dog. That is my response. Of course, you can't come up with a Christian argument for why pagans might be right. They're not. But what you can come up with is a Christian argument, and I would be very curious. I have friends who are Orthodox Jews who tell me that such an argument exists within Judaism, too. It's not my place to say whether it does or doesn't. But
practically?
No. The argument that I'm about to enunciate, and that is, This is the Catholic argument, and I'm not saying it should be the Jewish argument. I'm just simply saying it's the Catholic argument, and that I'm curious as to whether an analog exists, that people have the right to be wrong because they're created in the image and likeness of God, which gives them the ability to know and to choose and therefore quintessentially to love. And that the image and likeness of God, in the Catholic view of the phrase from the book of Genesis, has everybody seeking transcendence, thirsting out for, as I said in my remarks, for freedom or for a truth that lies beyond the horizon of themselves. So it's not a good thing to be a pagan, but it's a good thing to seek for God, and it's such a good thing to seek for God that you have the right to be wrong, even though you're wrong. So that's the basis that the Beckett Fund defends religious liberty for everybody on. Not that all religions are equal, they're not, but rather that all human beings are equal, and that while error may have no rights, erring people do.
It's 9 o'clock, and actually we're just getting started, but we have to bring it to a close. So I thank you for your attentiveness. I hope you've been intellectually stimulated by the presentations and discussions. And I thank our hosts and our speakers. Thank you.
I enjoyed your remarks very much. I'm 100% on board, but only practically.
No, I understand. Only practically.